What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast. Today, we have the privilege of hosting a literary luminary in the realms of science fiction and fantasy. He's the creative mind behind the captivating world of Toons, and the mastermind who brought us the iconic Who Censored Roger Rabbit? None other than the brilliant Gary K. Wolfe. A maestro of imagination, Gary K. Wolfe has woven tales that transcend the ordinary, blending detective fiction, humor, and fantasy in ways that have captivated readers and inspired the iconic film Who Framed Roger Rabbit, one of my personal favorites. So join us as we delve into the extraordinary mind of this esteemed author, exploring his literary journey, insights into his creative process, and the impact of his work on popular culture. And now I give you Gary K. Wolfe.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolfe. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Gary K. Wolfe. Gary, thanks for joining me again, sir.
Hey, it's my great pleasure. You know, at this stage of my career, it's just nice to be anywhere on the side of the dirt. And it's especially nice to be remembered for whatever reasons.
Yeah, right on. That's a good way of thinking about it. I'm excited to have you. Our listeners may or may not know this, but you actually graced us with your presence on my old podcast a few years back. And that was very well received, not because of me, I'm sure, but because of the charisma and presence of Gary K. Wolfe.
Well, you're too kind, but I remember that one because, as I recall, we were talking on two cans and a string, and it was really a pretty basic arrangement, and then we were taking Polaroids and kind of passing them back and forth. But I guess it must have gotten the job done, because look where you are now, you know?
Oh, that's kind of you to say, yeah, and I do vaguely remember sending you a Morse code at some point as well in the conversation.
Well, you're showing your age, which is considerably younger than me, but I was just talking to somebody else about Morse code, and they had no conception of what Morse code was. And I said, well, you know, it's dots and dashes, and they used to use that before they had email, And a little known fact, but, you know, SOS is dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. And that's SOS, and the first SOS signal was sent out from the Titanic.
Yep. Little fun fact for our listeners. So, Gary, I'm really excited to have you on again. Love to track through everything. Before we do, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love for you to take a second, just please tell our listeners briefly sort of who you are and what you do.
Sure. I'm Gary K. Wolfe. I'm a writer. I write novels. I write screenplays. And don't do much else, but I guess that's pretty much enough to keep me busy. A lot of letters to my mother, too. I have been writing almost my whole life. I started way back in second grade and haven't stopped since. I'm best known, perhaps, for creating Roger Rabbit, Jessica Rabbit, all the characters of Toontown, and that whole concept of Toons coexisting with humans in a fantasy world. I've written three Toontown novels, four, if you want to count my newest, which is a Jessica Rabbit origins novel, which talks about how Jessica went from becoming a plain and not particularly attractive shop girl named Jessica Krumsky, how she went from that to becoming Jessica Rabbit. So, you know, four. And I, you know, I've had some success in my career. My first book, Who Said Sir Roger Rabbit, was made into the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and got me a lot of movie work. It got me accepted as a, you know, a legitimate writer, professional writer. And that's it's been a good life. Let's hope it goes on for a while.
That's wonderful, Gary. Thank you. I appreciate it. I was trying to think what a great way to start this off might be. And I wanted to keep it fresh for you and not repeat the same thing we did last time. But I think,
oh, I don't mind. I don't remember what we did. I don't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday morning. So, you know, look, you got a new audience. Let's do it again.
Yeah. Well, the story is just so damn good. I just can't help myself. So when we spoke a couple years ago, Gary, you told me that really awesome story of when Steven Spielberg asked you for an autographed copy of your original book, Who Censored Roger Rabbit?
Yeah, I'll preface that by saying when the movie came out, I was doing a lot of personal appearances. I was on The Tonight Show. I was on, you know, a lot of late night TV shows, and I was giving a lot of speeches. And my cousin was teaching a third grade class in a suburb of Chicago, and I was in Chicago. And so she asked me if I would come over and talk to her third grade class. And I said, absolutely, I'd love to do that. Well, I came in and they were a little bit below my my usual level. I mean, when she told her Roger Rabbit's creator was coming in, they expected to see Roger Rabbit and me. So they were a little disappointed. And they told them my stories and how I became a writer and all that kind of stuff, and they seemed to like it. And afterwards, this one little third grader came up to me and said to me, he said, I am the school reporter. I run the school newspaper, and I would like to interview you for the school newspaper. I said, great. You know, that's great. So he interviewed me, and, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes, had the usual kind of questions, and at the end of the interview, he says, okay, that's all. And I said, well, wait a minute. I was a journalism major, and I'm going to give you one hint if you want to be a reporter. He said, before you end the interview, you always have to ask your subject, now, all right, one last question. Tell me something that you've never told anybody, all right? And a lot of times people will fall for that, and they'll tell you stuff that they wouldn't otherwise tell you. And he said, oh, okay, thank you. I said, now, what are you going to do? He said, oh, well, tell me something that you've never told anybody. So I told him a story that I had never told anybody because I didn't want a certain person to find out about it. And that person was Steven Spielberg, because when we were making the movie, Steve had read the book when it first came out. And he came to me when we were filming the book, and he said, you know, filming the movie, he said, you know, I read your book a long time ago. I said, I've got a paperback, but I would really love to have an autographed hardback copy of the book. Can you make that happen? I said, absolutely. I mean, you can't say no to Steven Spielberg. Well, when the book came out, it came out in 1981, and it was certainly by far my biggest success ever of any book I'd ever written. So successful that people were writing me letters and telling me, geez, I read your book, and I really loved your book. And this had never happened before with any of my other science fiction books. So St. Martin's had sent me a case of books. I had 50 books. And so whenever somebody wrote me a letter and said, I really loved your book, I would autograph a copy and send it to them. And pretty soon I had no books left. Well, I mean, so what? I knew what it was, and I had read it myself, and I didn't really need 50 copies. So I had none. I had no copies of my own book to autograph to give to Steve Spielberg. So I had to go to an antiquarian bookstore that sold rare and collectible books. And I had to pay $350 for a mint condition, mint in a wrapper copy of my own book, which I then autographed and gave to Steve Spielberg. But I never told Steve Spielberg that he had a secondhand book, because you just don't give Steve Spielberg a secondhand book, right? So I told that story to the kid. The kid says, oh, that's a great story. So he printed it in his school newspaper, which a lot of people probably don't remember mimeograph machines, but it was run off on a mimeograph machine, which was the early Xerox, and went out to all the schools. And I thought that was the end of it. Well, it turned out that one of the kid's classmates was a Strayer reporter for the Associated Press. And he read that newsletter and he said, wow, what a great story. And he put that story on the Associated Press wire. And it went out to every newspaper in the United States. And judging from the response I got, I'm guessing 3/4 of the newspapers in the United States picked it up and printed it. And so there went my cover story. You know, Stephen hasn't spoken to me since. But what happened as a result of that, when that story came out, 35 of the people that I sent those books to read that story and sent them back. Mm. And they all said basically the same thing. They said, you know, you shouldn't be without a copy of your own book. Thank you for sending this to me. I've enjoyed it, but now you should have it back. And I thought that was really sweet. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really sweet. Thank you, Gary, for running through it. I appreciate it. That's a great story.
Well, let me tell you, I was just thinking about this today because of this, of course, being interviewed on a podcast by a real prime interviewer. But I always try and support students, especially student journalists, because I was in journalism. I was a journalism major, journalism and advertising. And I know how hard it is to do that. And I know what a tough life it is after you get out and you go into the business. So I'm always good to students, particularly journalism students. So I went to the University of Illinois. So a couple of years ago, this young guy from the University of Illinois called me up and got my name from the Alumni Association. And he said, you know, I'm in the journalism school and I'm supposed to interview a famous alum. And you are the most famous alum that I could find. So can I interview you? And I, sure, absolutely. I said, I'll give you half an hour. So he said, okay, let me prepare and I'll call you back. So we set a time. Week later, kid calls me back. And he had read every single thing I had ever written, the short stories, the novels, the articles, everything. He had read every article that had ever been written on me. He knew everything about me. And instead of just asking me the usual questions, he was asking me, it was almost like psychoanalysis. He was asking me questions about my motives and my motivations and my deepest thoughts when I was writing something. And did I realize that this particular thing in this book also was reflected in something else in another book? And I really had to think about the answers to the questions. And I really wound up at the end of that interview kind of reevaluating my own thought process and my own creativity. It was barely the best interview I'd ever had in my life, you know, up until this one.
Of course.
Barely the best interview I'd ever had in my life. And we went out for 3 hours.
Wow.
Talked to the kid for 3 hours. So at the end of the interview, I said to the kid, look, give me the name of your professor. I said, I'm going to call him. And he said, hey, you deserve an A+ on this. So he gave me the name of his professor. I called his professor. I said, hey, this kid is fantastic. He said, best interview I've ever had. And I've had thousands of interviews. This was the best. He said, he deserves an A+. He says, yeah, she's a very good journalism student. He's going to have a fine future in journalism. So that was that. I thought, 2 weeks later, the kid calls me again. He says, you know, he said, that interview I did with you was the most stressful thing I'd ever done in my whole life. He said, it was so stressful, I realized that I'm not cut out for journalism. So I've dropped out of journalism and I've changed my major to anthropology. So I don't have to deal with people anymore. I need things that I dig out of the ground. And I'm thinking to myself, holy hell, what would have happened if Katie Couric had been, you know, I had been Katie Couric's first interview? How would journalism have changed?
Run her out too, right?
Run her out too. Yeah, and I don't want you leaving for like some Indiana Jones adventure, all right?
No, sir. No, I'm here to stay. That's hilarious. Yeah. I tell you, this would be a good transition to Toontown and Roger Rabbit and the rest of it, just staying on Spielberg for a minute. I seem to recall from our last interview, wasn't there something to do with having Disney characters and WB characters in the same, they had to be equal characters in the same scene? And Steven Spielberg.
When we were making the movie, the original intention was, it was always live action animation. It was always going to be live action animation combined. And in the early days when Roy Disney was in charge of the project, that first of all, Disney didn't have a lot of clout. That's why they bought the movie in the first place, because they were in danger of becoming a kind of a second-rate movie house. They hadn't had any hits. They had been offered E.T. and passed on it. They'd been offered Jaws and passed on it. They'd been offered Star Wars and passed on it. They were in danger of becoming a second-rate movie house, so they needed a big hit. And they saw Roger Rabbit as being that big hit. So they were trying to produce a live-action animation. And admittedly, this was 1980, 81, 82, 83, 84. And admittedly, the technology wasn't there yet. They didn't have the technology that came in 85, 86, 87. And in fact, a lot of the technology that we used in Roger Rabbit was invented for Roger Rabbit. So I can't fault them for not being able to bring it off. But, you know, at one point, Roy Disney came to me and said, you know, we're not having any luck doing this as a live-action animated movie. What would you think if instead of having animated characters, we had characters like we have them at Disneyland in costume, you know? And I'm thinking, oh, no. I said, I'm going to have Fred McMurray as Eddie Valiant. I'm going to have Haley Mills as Jessica, Dean Jones as the rabbit, and Kurt Russell as B.B. Herman. I said, hey, don't you think that compromises the principle just a little bit? He said, yeah. So Roy Disney went off and they kept trying to do it. And Roy Disney said, well, it would be great if we had characters from other studios in this movie, not just Disney characters, but other characters. So he went to Warner Brothers and he knocked on the door and went in and Roy Disney and said, look, we're making a live action animated movie. It's going to be a really big deal for us. And we would like to have Bugs Bunny do a cameo, you know, just come on screen, say, what's up, Doc? And bite a carrot and walk off, you know, 20 seconds of screen time. What do you think? And Warner Brothers looked at Roy Disney and says, get lost. And there's no way that Bugs Bunny is ever going to be in a Walt Disney picture. That it was just never going to happen. So 4 years later, that was probably 83, 85, Steve Spielberg was on board now, and he was the producer. Steve Spielberg said, you know, it'd be kind of cool to have characters from other studios. So Steve Spielberg goes to Warner Brothers, and they say, they didn't go request, hey, we're making a live-action animated movie over at Disney, and I'm producing it for him. How about if we, can we have Bugs Bunny just walk on stage, walk on screen, and say, what's up, Doc? And they look at Steve Spielberg, and they say, of course, Steven. Bugs Bunny, absolutely. What about Porky Pig? What about the Roadrunner? Wile E. Coyote? Yeah, you know, 70 Sam, Diane, Tweety, Bert, and Sylvester. Take them all. I'll take them all. Put them all in there. And so Steven walked out with the entire stable of characters. And the only codicil was that Bugs Bunny being the Warner Brothers superstar and a contract. And in his contract, it specified that Bugs Bunny had to be in every scene with Mickey Mouse because they were co-equal superstars. You could not have Mickey Mouse in a scene without Bugs. Although, I just noticed this a little while ago, there is a scene of Bugs without Mickey. So maybe Mickey's attorney wasn't quite as clever.
Goofy was his lawyer, right?
So they had to be in every scene together, and they had to have the exact same number of words of dialogue. And if you go through and watch the movie, you'll see that they're in every scene together. And if you count however many words of dialogue they have, they're identical. A couple of other sort of interesting sidelights. Another something I just found out. The Bugs in the movie is not the modern Bugs. It's the 1946 Bugs. And there's a difference. I mean, you can Google search images and you'll see that that Bugs has changed his appearance. As has Mickey, as has Donald, Doug, they all have. But the Bugs in the movie was a 1946 Bugs because it's a 1946 movie and the animators wanted to be consistent. So they were doing the 1946 Bugs. Well, Warner Brothers came over and said, oh, no. No, we want the modern Bugs. You've got to use the modern Bugs. You can't use the 1946 Bugs. And so the Disney guys, and they were pretty, I would hate to say, let's just say mean about this. They really wanted it. So the Disney animators, who didn't think too much of Warner Brothers, the studio, did two versions. They did one version with the 1946 Bugs, and then they did another version with the modern Bugs, the animated two different versions. They showed the modern version to Warner Brothers, and they put the 1946 version in the movie.
Hmm.
And Warner Brothers did not realize it until one of the Warner's executives went to the premiere and saw the movie and said, that's the 1946 books. But it turned out that the movie was such a colossal hit.
Yeah.
You know, it made so much money and, you know, a top grossing movie of the year, four Academy Awards, that all of a sudden Warner Brothers realized, hey, maybe we got something going here. And they started producing because they wanted to sell dolls. They wanted to sell dolls or toys, and they didn't want to sell dolls or toys for an old rabbit. They wanted to sell it for that new rabbit. They realized that they could now start making the retro books. And so they started making retro books dolls and selling those, and they kind of, you know, increased their profit share. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that story. The other story that I did know, the animators, as I say, hated Warner Brothers because they were constantly criticizing and complaining and constantly on their backs. And it wasn't their movie. It was the Disney movie, but the Warner Brothers people were treating it like it was their movie. So when Bugs and Mickey are parachuting down with Eddie Valiant, and Eddie Valiant says, hey, got a spare, and Bugs gives him a spare tire. When they're doing that, and when Bugs and Mickey are talking to one another, there's something called gags in the margins. And a gag in the margins, film goes through a projector at 24 frames a second. So you need to draw, animate 24 pictures or cells per second in order to match that. You know, that's called animating on the ones, you know, 1, 1, 1, 24, 24. A lot of Saturday morning cartoons animates on the twos, so they do one every 12. And that's why Saturday morning cartoons looks a little choppy and a little shaky. You know, some really low-budget animation things animate on the threes. But, you know, if you animate on the ones, 24 cells a second, you can mess around with six of those cells. So 6/24 of a second, you can mess around with them and put in little gags. And nobody can see they're there because they go by too quickly, all right? And the only people who used to be able to see they were there were the projectionists in the projection rooms in theaters. And Betty Boop cartoons had them. Every time Betty Boop says, hey, I still got it, and I boop, boop, be-doop, the front of her dress would fall down. And she'd come back, and then she reached out, put it back up 6 seconds. There were tons and tons and tons of these in the old cartoons, and the projectionists used to look through and find them. And then cut them out and save once. So they put a gag in the margin in the Bugs Bunny Mickey Mouse scene. When they're parachuting down, they wanted to have Mickey give Bugs the finger. Okay? So this was being done at Dick Williams' studio in London. And Dick had hired a lot of expatriate animators, a lot of Eastern Europeans who came over when their curtain fell, and a lot of Spanish, Greek. It's like a little United Nations over there. And so they had, I think it was, I don't know what the guy's nationality was. Let's just say he was Italian, but I don't remember. They had an Italian guy. And they said, okay, here's the gag we want you to do. We want you to have Mickey giving Bugs the finger as they're going down. But they couldn't, nobody could communicate directly with him because nobody spoke Italian. So they had to talk to the Spanish guy who spoke to the Ukrainian guy who then spoke to the Italian guy, right? So they did it, and they went in the movie, and nobody realized until afterwards when they looked at it as the movie was already finished that he had gotten the message wrong. And so if you look at that scene, and you can do it now on a DVD, you can look at it frame by frame. If you look at that scene on a DVD, you will see that as they're going down, that instead of Mickey giving Bugs the finger, it is Bugs who is giving Mickey the finger. And it's entirely the wrong message. Although probably closer to the actual truth of the way the relationship was between Disney and Warner Brothers.
That's hilarious. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about creating Roger Rabbit in Toontown. If I remember correctly, your inspiration came from cereal commercials, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a four-novel contract with Doubleday, and I had written three of those novels. They were all science fiction novels, and basically, my contract was I could write anything I wanted. I send us a novel. We'll publish it. We really like your work and on, you know, whatever you do. So I wrote 3 science fiction novels. And for the 4th one, I wanted to go outside the envelope a little bit. I wanted to incorporate the things that I had loved and enjoyed when I was a kid. And those were cartoons, comic books, comic strips, and oddly, a noir detective novels. That's what I liked as a kid. And, you know, obviously you can see where the comic books came from because I was a kid and I read comic books. But my dad read what they call it, these true crime magazines. And I don't think they exist anymore. I hope they don't exist anymore. But they were like the early equivalent of a really gruesome reality show. These true crime magazines had articles about true crimes. And they were always murders. And they had photographers. One of the most famous ones is a guy named Ouija. And he would be on the police band radio, and he would go to the scene of a murder and sometimes get there before the police. And he would rearrange the corpses so that they were more photogenic, and that he would take pictures of them, and he would sell them to these true crime magazines so they would print them. If you ever saw a movie with Tom Hanks called Road to Perdition, Jude Law played a kind of a Ouija guy, and that's where that came from. And that's what my dad read, you know. So they were around the house, and so I read them too. And my mom, good mother that she was, she encouraged me to read, but she didn't really care what I read. So she never once said, "Hey, don't read that stuff, it'll rot your brain." She's like, "It rotted your dad's brain." So luckily, I graduated to a better class of mystery, Dashiell Hammett, Mickey Spillane, and whatever. But I grew up reading that kind of stuff, and that's what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write some kind of a novel with comic strips, cartoons, and private eyes. And, you know, not an easy concept to relate to and put together. So I was watching Saturday morning cartoons one Saturday morning, you know, for research. I told my wife, you know, I'm just watching these for research and not really a child at heart. And so I'm watching them, and I was really taken, not with the cartoons, which, as we all know, because I just explained it, were animated out of the twos. And we're kind of choppy and not at all like the cartoons I remember, you know, Pinocchio and Donald Duck, all that kind of stuff. But I wasn't taken with them, but I was taken with the commercials because there were cartoon characters talking to real kids, and nobody seemed to think that was odd. You know, I had Captain Crunch and Tony the Tiger and the Trix Rabbit and Snap, Crackle, and Pop. And these kids were talking to real kids, and everybody accepted that. And I said, wow, you know, there's an idea. What would you have if you had a world where cartoon characters were real? What kind of a world would that be? So I spent a year researching. I looked into all the different things that cartoons and comic strips did that would be really hilarious if they happened in a real world. And the one that I'm proudest of, the characters in my first novel, Who Censored Roger Rabbit, are not cartoon stars. They're stars in comic books and comic strips. Roger's the star of a comic strip, is it B.B. Herman. And they don't speak in words. They speak in word balloons. So you don't speak to them. You will talk to them, and they hear you, and then they put up a word balloon, and you read them. And, you know, if they turn around, then their word balloon turns around. So you either have to learn to read backwards, or you have to go around to the other side. Somebody gets shot with a bang balloon. Bang balloons are very brittle. They're like plates. Glass plates, and they'll break when they hit the sidewalk. But if they don't, you can pick up the bang balloon, and then if you find the gun you think committed the crime, you can produce another bang balloon and match them up. But if the two bang balloons match, that's the gun. Yeah, and when somebody plays the piano, the notes go trailing off, and people collect those strings of notes and cut them into 8x12 sheets, and that's where sheet music comes from. So I had a lot of fun playing with that concept and others. You know, I had to. They call it world building now. We didn't call it building back then, but we call it world building now. And I had to basically go into Toontown every day, every morning when I was writing this, and just look around and look at what I see and describe what I saw and, you know, make a story out of it. And hardest thing I've ever done in my life, still is. I mean, sorry, still have to do that. But because there's so many things you have to think about, like what kind of bars are there in Toontown, right? You know, are there Toon bars. Well, sure, they're Toon bars. What do they drink at Toon bars? Well, they drink Toon tonic. And, you know, a Toon tonic, it comes in a jug and you drink it by putting it over your shoulder and, you know, drinking it. What happens if a human drinks Toon tonic? Or what happens can a Toon go into a human bar? Well, what happens if a Toon goes into a human bar and has a drink? What happens to him then? Well, I think you saw that in a movie.
Yes.
And, you know, there's an undercurrent throughout the book that a lot of people recognize. Steve Spielberg did and Bob Zemeckis, the director, did. There's an undercurrent of a kind of racial inequities. The Toons are second-class citizens. The Toons are the blacks and the Pakistanis and the, you know, the downtrodden peoples of the world. And the humans are the upper class. And, you know, that was in the book and it comes across pretty well in the movie, I think. So I wrote the book and signed up to Doubleday. And of course, it was the fourth book of my four book contract. And for the first time in my writing career, I got a reject. I'd never had a reject. Short stories, 100 short stories, 3 novels, never had a reject. And they rejected it. And so I called my editor. I said, Sheridan, why did you reject this book? And I said, this is the best thing I've ever written. She said, oh, yeah, I agree. She says, it's a wonderful book, you know, funny, but it's so different from anything you've ever written before. So different from anything anybody's ever written before that I had to send it to the marketing department. So I sent it to the marketing department, and they were the ones who rejected it. So I called the marketing department, and I talked to the head of marketing. I said, Chuck, you know, why'd you reject my book? He said, oh, I said, we all love that book. Oh, it's really funny, but it's not like any book that's ever been published before. I said, there's no category for this on a bookstore shelf. I can't sell this book. There's no place I can put it on the bookstore shelf. I said, all right. What would you do if somebody today gave you The Wizard of Oz or Alice in Wonderland or Gulliver's Travels? What would you do with those? And he thought for a minute. He says, man, I couldn't sell those either. So I called my agent and I said, Bill, I said, if I can't publish this book, I don't want to be a writer anymore. Because this is what I want to do. I had fun doing this. I want to do more of this. I don't want to do anything else. And he said, oh, don't worry. We'll find a home for it. So he started sending it out to other editors and other publishers, sometimes multiple editors at the same publisher. And along the way, it was rejected 110 times, always for the same reason. We can't sell this book. Well, you know, there's no place for this. The bookstore shelves. We can't sell this book. In those days, you got rejects by letter. They came by mail. Email had not been invented yet. And my wife used to call my trip office in the mailbox every night the daily disappointments, because I'd go out to the mailbox and I'd come back with sometimes 5 rejects. So on a 111th submission, it went to a young woman named Rebecca Martin. She was an editor at St. Martin's Press. And she had just published a big major bestseller for them. And so the president of the company gave her a vanity project. He said, all right, you can publish any book you want. Your next book could be any book you want. And just at that time, Roger Rabbit came across her desk. So she read it, loved it. Like, editors always loved it. It's always the marketing department. So she took it to the president of the company and said, here, this is the book that I want to publish. And he said, okay, I'm going to read it tonight. I'll get back to you in the morning. So he took it home, called her in the next morning. He said, Rebecca, I read this book. And I said you could publish anything you wanted, but you can't publish this because I can't sell it. And Rebecca stepped up to the plate and said, look, told me I could publish anything I wanted. You publish that or I quit. And so they published it, but in very, very small quantities, less than 5,000 copies, which is really next to nothing. And, you know, people ask me if I could have a time machine and I could go back in time, what would I change? What would I do that I hadn't done, or what would I tell my younger self? And what I would do is I would go back to 1981 when that book came out, and I would buy all 5,000 copies because it cost $2.98 in 1981. And now on eBay, if you can find a copy, it's well north of $500. So I would have bought them all, and I would have put them in a barn somewhere. And now I would be living in Spain. And I would be talking to Katie Couric instead of here. Yeah. So anyway, it did come out. And, you know, I did get some justification after Disney and, well, after Steve Spielberg came on board, and then and Disney announced that it was going to be a Steve Spielberg movie. Valentine picked up the paperback rights, and it came out with the first little blurb on it was the cult classic, And then they changed that to soon to be a major motion picture. And in paperback, it went through at least 16 printings. I don't know, might still be being printed today. I have no idea. But it went through 16 printings. After the movie came out, and I wrote the sequel, which is who loved Roger Rabbit, I sent that to my agent, and he set it out. They had a bidding war. They had 10 publishers who were bidding to publish that one. And the feel-good story of that is that all 10 of those publishers had rejected the first one once. Four of them had rejected the first one twice, and three of them had rejected the first one three times. So...
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I appreciate you taking a minute on rejection, because just as you have a soft spot for journalists, I have a soft spot for writers. And anytime a good word can be put in for, you know, coming up on the other side of rejection, it's a story well worth hearing.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people who are beginning writers ask me, well, you know, what do I do when I get rejected? I say, if you want to be a writer, you got to have a thick skin. But the main thing is you have to really believe in what you're doing. If you believe that what you have is good and worthwhile, then it'll be successful, and you'll be successful. What I find is that most people give up too soon. You know, most people give up after 6, 10 rejects, 20 rejects, 50, 75, you know, 110 rejects. That's a lot of rejects and a lot of rejection. And you just got to keep going, especially now in this climate, where it's actually much easier in a lot of ways to get a book published than it used to be, because you can actually publish it yourself and make more money at it. The trick is not getting it published. The trick is letting people know that it exists. So now the trick isn't to publish your book, but promote your book. And that's a whole different category for a lot of writers. A lot of writers who are really, really great writers are not particularly adept at promoting themselves. Like, I mean, God help it, me if, you know, me talking about myself for an hour, I think that's just virtually impossible. But, you know, there are a lot of people who can't do that. So that's really the trick. And, you know, what I advise is a lot of writers to do in order to help them promote their stuff is I ask them to devote half an hour a day to promoting their book. You know, let's assume that you're going to go to Amazon. Amazon will publish your book. That's it. And I don't think they even charge for it. I'm not sure, but I don't think they do. And they'll publish your book, and they take a percentage. And the percentage that they take is far, far, far less than the percentage that Random House is going to take. Mm-hmm. So you're actually going to make more money. But then it's up to you to promote your book. And I ask writers who take that route, which I think is a perfectly valid route nowadays. Even Stephen King did it. I ask writers who do that to devote a half an hour a day to promoting their book and promoting themselves. That's all. I just spend a half an hour a day thinking, what can I do today to get my book out in front of public? And, you know, what I used to do myself was start small. I would start with my local hometown newspaper, which was the Earlville Leader, you know, which circulation of 1,400 people. I mean, probably not that much, because there were 1,400 people in town. I don't think they all subscribed. So let's say a circulation of 300 people. Yeah. And, you know, hometown boy writes a book. They did a really nice article on me. You then take that article and send it to the next biggest paper in the next biggest town, which was the Mendota Times, and say, hey, look, their own little paper did this on me. Would you do this? And they did. And I worked my way from Earlville to Mendota to Aurora to one of the Chicago suburbs to the Chicago Tribune. And then from the Chicago Tribune to the New York Times. And it works. You know, it works. You know, nowadays you can do a tremendous amount of self-promotion on podcasts. Here you go. I guess I don't have the time or the inclination or really the talent to do my own podcast, but I've talked to writers who do, and a lot of them wind up making, you know, a lot of new fans and sometimes some serious money from podcasts. I don't know. I mean, you probably, you have a sponsor, right? Coca-Cola, I think, or is it Budweiser? I'm not sure who's sponsoring it today, but tell me and I'll hold up the can.
Well, I'm proud to say that this podcast is owned by Salem Media Group.
But, you know, I use their face cream every night, and I've got to tell you, my face feels as soft and silky as a baby. Thank you, Salem Media Group, for what you've done for me.
And now a word from Chesterfield Cigarettes.
Yes. Now, so now Salem Media Group is going to send me a box of what? I don't know. Old magazines.
Exactly. Excellent. So, yeah, the movie, of course, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, released in 1988. I think I told you last time we spoke, Gary, one of my favorite movies. I know there were a lot of changes in plot and general structure from the book, Who Censored Roger Rabbit. Yeah, I'd love to know what your initial thoughts were upon seeing the movie for the first time. And I'm especially keen to tease you about that Dick Williams opener.
Oh, sure. Well, it's not like they took the book and went away and made the movie and then came back and said, hey, Gary, look at what we did. I mean, I was involved in the process all the way. In the early days, I was involved because Roy Disney would call me up and tell me what kind of progress they were making. He was a great guy about that. You know, he was good at writers. He liked writers. And he would call me up and tell me the progress. You know, he'd tell me about the, you know, let's do the thing is costume characters instead of animated characters. And I didn't actually sit in on any strategy sessions, but I knew what was going on. When Steve Spielberg took over and brought in Bob Zemeckis, Steve and Bob Z had read my book, and they invited me out, and I sat in on a couple of the creative sessions, and they really liked my ideas. They thought I had some good suggestions. And the animators, whenever I would walk into the animation room, they would say, this is Gary Wolfe. It was like Moses coming down from the mountain, you know, and he's bearing two stone tablets on which are writ large the words Roger Rabbit, you know. I mean, idolize me was probably not even accurate enough. I mean, I got a lot of respect from the animators. And so I sat in a lot of meetings. I'm not a movie maker. I'm not a script writer. And I find the movie making process itself to be pretty tedious and boring. But I did spend a lot of time on the set in England where they were filming at Elstree Studios, in L.A. when they were filming, and at ILM when they were doing the special effects and the sound work, just because it was, you know, interesting to me, and it was so totally outside my area of expertise and my experience that I just had, yeah, I mean, they had to do it. And Disney welcomed me. They would invite me out. They would pay for me to come out. They'd fly me out first class. I stay at a nice hotel in London. They gave me a car and a driver. Yeah, really. And I mean, I'm from Illinois, right? It's farm town in Illinois, and I've got a car and driver in London. And I told my wife, I said, you know, I said, the only thing that could make this better is that if I could tell my driver to take me to the carriage entrance at Harrods Department Store and let me out of the carriage entrance to Harrods Department Store, and I would get out, and the whole town of Worldville would be there to see me get out of the car. I mean, that would be super. So I saw everything that was going on as it was going on, and I knew what was happening, and I knew they changed the story. I didn't have a problem with that because the book is a book and the movie is a movie. And I wrote the book to be the best possible book that I knew how to write. And in the book, if you read the book, and I think everybody should read it because it's a work of brilliant genius. Everybody should read it. But the book makes readers use their imagination. You get into it, and it's very easy. I mean, the word balloons and the fact that these are comic strip characters and not cartoon characters, you know, you get into that and you accept it, and it all works. That concept doesn't work on the screen. In the early days, we tried using word balloons instead of having them talk, and it just absolutely didn't work because it became a silent movie. You know, cartoon character would talk, word balloon would go up, audience would have to read it, action would slow down. So it was obvious that that wasn't going to work. And I said, this isn't going to work. They changed the story. They always change the story from a book to a movie. The book story is much, much, much complex than the movie story. So they changed the story, simplified it, and I have no problem with it. The thing that they did that they didn't have to do, but they did anyway, was they kept my characters. They kept Roger Rabbit, Jessica Rabbit, Baby Herman, Eddie Valiant, the whole concept of Toontown, and they could have changed those characters. They could have made him Roger Raccoon, and I don't know, Sally Smith, or I don't know. But they kept all of the characters, and the characters in the movie look exactly the way I described them in the book. So, and in fact, they used a lot of my dialogue. I'm not Ben, I'm just drawn that way. I've got a 50-year-old lust and a 3-year-old dinky, which is my personal favorite, but doesn't get a lot of play in family media. And, you know, so it wasn't a big shock to me when I saw the movie, because I knew what they were doing, and I saw it. I'd seen it all. But you are right. I had never seen the movie start to finish, because they were working on it, piece. You know, I saw the filming of the live action, but I didn't see it. And I saw the animators working on the animation. Didn't see a lot of the animation and live action combined, because that was being done at ILM. And I'd never seen the whole movie start to finish. I'd seen many, many bits and pieces, but never the whole movie start to finish. So the premiere was at Radio City Music Hall in New York City. It was kind of a sop to me, so I wouldn't have to go to LA. You know, I could just go from Boston down to New York. And so I went to the Radio City Music Hall, and I'm sitting in the VIP section, which was the first balcony, and I'm going to see my movies all the way through, start to finish, for the very first time. And I'm going to see my credit on screen for the very first time, because I hadn't seen that either. It could be my credit on screen. And on my left is Kathleen Turner, who was the voice of Jessica Rabbit, who was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life, right? And on my right was Amy Irving, who was the singing voice of Jessica Rabbit, Steven Spielberg's wife at the time, probably the second most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my life. So I'm sitting here in between these two gorgeous women, and I'm getting ready to see my movie on screen and my credit for the first time, and I'm thinking, you know, life just doesn't get any better than this. And then, by golly, life got better, because Kathleen reached over and put her hand on my leg, and she whispered in my ear, she said, "Gary, are you excited?" I looked at her and, "Kathleen, you have no idea." nobody really knew if this movie was going to be a smash hit or another Howard the Duck.
Right.
But it turned out to be the highest grossing movie of 1988. We won 4 Academy Awards. I won the Hugo Award, which is the big science fiction award for that movie. And the day after the movie, I was just thinking about this yesterday. It's almost like a Christmas story. The day after the movie, my wife and I had heard that they had merchandise at Macy's. They had Roger Rabbit merchandise. By merchandise, Batman came out a little before Roger Rabbit, I believe. And Batman really kind of set the standard for merchandise. I mean, they really merchandised Batman. And I was kind of hoping that there was going to be some Roger Rabbit merchandise too. So my wife and I had heard that there was merchandise at Macy's, which was just down the street from Radio City and Music Hall, and we were staying in a hotel right across the street. So the first day I got up in the morning, I looked out the window, and I could see Radio City Music Hall from my hotel window, and there was a line around the corner, people waiting to get in the movie. And they had shown the movie. They started showing the movie at midnight that night, and they were showing it around the clock, continuing showing. And there were people waiting to get in. And I thought, this is good. So my wife and I went to Macy's, and we walked in the door, and I said to the young woman, the information desk, I said, "Do you have Roger Rabbit merchandise?" And she said, "Oh, yes, we do." And I said, "Where is it?" "Just second floor." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, we're on the second floor." "Just second floor." That's how we go up, and the elevator doors part, and the whole second floor is Roger Rabbit merchandise, the whole floor of Macy's. And I had told my wife, I said, "You know, if they've got anything, I'm going to buy the first thing I see. And it's going to be my lucky piece of Roger Rabbit merchandise for the rest of my life." And the door opened, and the first thing I saw on a little pedestal right outside the elevator was a Roger Rabbit lunchbox, right? A plastic lunchbox with a thermos inside. And I got to buy it. And first thing I saw, I got to buy it. And I'm so sorry that it wasn't, you know, this, or one of the Wendy Gelb tins, or I still got it, a plastic lunchbox. So my wife and I are walking the aisles, looking at all the Roger Rabbit merchandise. And all of a sudden, I turn a corner, and there's Charlie Fleischer, who's the voice of Roger Rabbit. And I said, Charlie, what do you think of this? He said, it's amazing. I said, Charlie, you got a piece of this? And he says, yeah, everything that's got my voice in it. I said, so there's things with your voice? He says, yeah, this doll over here. And he pulls a plush doll off the shelf, and it's got a little pull tag string on the back. And when you pull it, it said like five things. It said, I just flew in from Pittsburgh, and boy, are my arms tired. And it's raining cats and dogs, and I got hit by a Bowser. And it was Charlie. And I said, oh, Charlie, I said, I'm going to buy this. It's not the first thing I see, but I'm going to buy this. And will you autograph it for me? And Charlie Fleischer autographed the foot, my Roger Rabbit doll, with his signature on one and a drawing of Roger, which he can do really well, on the other foot. And that and the Roger Rabbit lunchbox are the two things that I have from that day that I kept forever that I'll never get rid of.
Wow.
Very happy with me.
That's an incredible story, Gary. Thank you. I know we're coming up on our time, Gary. I won't keep you for too much longer. But, oh, I'm sorry, Dick Williams.
Oh, Dick Williams. So Dick Williams, lead animator, he wanted to show to basically other animators at other studios and the world that Roger Rabbit was a tour de force of animation. It wasn't that it was the new wave of animation. It was as good or better than anything that had ever been done before. And he wanted to do that right out of the gate.
Yes.
So he started off with that in the old days, movies always had a cartoon, and it was always a 7 or 8 minute cartoon, Donald Duck, Woody Woodpecker, Bugs Bunny, whatever. So he wanted to start out with a cartoon so that it kind of mimicked the old 1940s movies.
Yeah.
So Dick Williams animated every single cell of that opening cartoon himself. Think about this. 24 frames a second, you do the math. Okay, that opening scene is probably 4 minutes long. So that's a ton of animation. And he didn't just do it. He did it to make it purposely more difficult for himself. Like when you see that kitchen floor and the rabbit is running around the kitchen floor, that kitchen floor is black and white tile. Now, there's no reason that has to be black and white tile. That could be an all-black floor, an all-white floor, an all-gray floor. But by making it black and white, the tile, every 24th of a second, the angle of the tile changes on every single tile. All right? So he has to adjust every single tile 24 frames a second. And then, to make it even harder, he put the rabbit's reflection into the tile. So now you've not got just the tile changing, but you've also got the rabbit's reflection changing. And when animators look at that, their jaws drop. I mean, that is just amazing. And the other really amazing bit of animation that, I mean, most people don't even realize it, but when Eddie, Roger, and Dolores are in the back room of the bar, the terminal bar, and they're talking, and Roger bumps that lamp, and the lamp starts swinging back and forth, back and forth. Well, the shadows change because of the lamp swing, and the shadows change that Roger is projecting, and also the shadows change on Roger's face. And that's an incredibly difficult piece of animation, incredibly difficult. So difficult that now when somebody does a piece of animation that's really spectacular, they refer to that as bumping the lamp. So that was Dick Williams. You know, everybody who was involved in this movie, I was probably the little rung on the totem pole, but everybody who was involved in this movie was absolutely at the top of their game. I mean, Steve Spielberg, Bob Zemeckis, Bob Hoskins, greatest actor I've ever dealt with in my life, should have won the Academy Award for that. It's my only regret at the movie. It wasn't even nominated because he made it look too easy.
Yeah.
You know, you don't realize that when he is performing that there's nothing there. He is performing in a vacuum.
I don't know if you saw this, Gary, but you can find it on YouTube. There's a side-by-side of the...
Yeah,
and it breaks my brain every time I see it. It's incredible.
Yeah, because he's making it all up. And something else I'm still learning new things about this movie that I didn't know. But in the scene where Eddie and Roger are in the alley, and he is talking to Roger, and Roger is up against the wall. And if you look at that, Roger is standing on his tiptoes, and he's kind of extending his body. And you look at it, and I mean, it looks perfectly normal, and it's just some goofy thing the rabbit would do. Well, the reason they did that was because that was one of the first scenes they shot. And Hoskins had not yet gotten the hang of looking the rabbit in the eyes, because his eyes had to match where the rabbit's eyes were. And of course, there was no rabbit. You know, they had a stand-in that they would put in so that he could figure it out, but then they would take it away for the filming. And so there was no rabbit. And it was Hoskins who had to make sure that his eyes were on the rabbit's eye level. That was one of the first scenes that they did, and he hadn't quite got it yet, and he was looking too high. His eye level was too high. And so when they saw it, they said, oh, geez, you know, do we have to reshoot the scene? They said, no, let's just have the rabbit kind of, you know, stand on his tiptoes and extend and go match the rabbit's eyes to Hoskins' eyes instead of Aaron Hoskins matching the rabbit's eyes. And nobody ever noticed that.
That's incredible. I never did. One last
one. You will.
Now I know. I'm a wiser man for it. One more question, sir, and then I can let you go. I really appreciate you taking the time from me, my friend. Have you been surprised by how warmly it's been received? I mean, there's been all similar movies, you know, Cool World, the great Ralph Bakshi of, I think, Felix the Cat fame, reached nowhere near the acclaim and legacy that Who Framed Roger Rabbit has. And I'm just curious if you're surprised by the legendless left.
Yeah, a couple of things. I can't put Cool World or Space Jam, or I can't put those in the same category as Roger Rabbit. They're just eons away from Roger. Roger would have well received for a couple of reasons. First, technically, it was superb. The acting was great. The story was great. I mean, this wasn't a kid's movie. This wasn't an animated movie. This was a movie, you know, as they say, about a man, a woman, and a rabbit in a triangle of trouble. I mean, this was a real movie. And Cool World wasn't. Cool World was a gimmick. Space Jam was a real gimmick. And the characters had depth, and you felt for Roger. You know, people have told me over and over, oh my God, I really felt for that rabbit because he had a personality and he had feelings. And then, you know, there's not a teenage boy in the world that didn't fall in love with Jessica. And, you know, Hollywood was okay, but she just wasn't Jessica. And I'm not surprised that people still watch this and nobody watches Cool World and nobody right. watches Space Jam. People still watch this because this is a classic. This is a classic movie. This is Gone with the Wind. This is The Wizard of Oz. It's in the Smithsonian in their National Heritage Archives, which is tough to do. And I guarantee you, Cool World will never make it. So I'm not surprised. And I'll tell you one other thing.
Yeah.
If I had known, I get probably every week, I probably get 35 to 40 pictures of young cosplaying women dressed as Jessica Rabbit. All right, 35 a week. And I print a lot of them. Some of them are unprintable. The ones that are printable, I print. And they're not unprintable because the women don't do a good job. They'll say the women do too good a job.
Yeah.
the ones that are printable, I print on my Facebook page. And if I had known when I was writing this book, or if I had known in high school, my God, that if I wrote this book, that there would come a time when 35 beautiful young women would be sending me pictures of themselves in low-cut red dresses, I would have written the book a whole lot sooner. I got to tell you. It would have been the first book in my Doubleday contract and not the fourth. Yeah.
Wonderful. Excellent. Gary K. Wolfe, that was all I had for you, my friend.
All right. Hey, plug for my website.
Absolutely.
www.garywolfe.com. You can read all about me and my projects and read about my new Jessica Rabbit book, Jessica Rabbit Serious Business, which is actually a woman's book. I wrote it. My beta readers were all women because I wanted to make sure that, you know, guy writing a book about the sex symbol of the 80s, 90s, and, you know, probably 2000s, wanted to make sure that I did not overly sexualize her. I didn't demean her. I didn't degrade her. And I wanted to make sure that she was not just a foil for the men. that she was their equal, and in lots of ways, they're better. So I had my beta readers were all women. I went out and I found the most militant feminist women I could. I had 35 of them, and they all read the book, and they all came back and said, you know, Jessica Rabbit is exactly the kind of woman I've always wanted to be. So for all you women out there, this is it. Role model for you young girls. Christmas is coming. Go to my website, www.garywolf.com. Buy in bulk. Wonderful Christmas presents, Hanukkah, whatever you got, okay?
Brilliant. Yeah, the perfect stocking stuffer. And I'll be sure to leave the pertinent links in the show notes here, Gary.
Oh, that'd be great. Thanks.
My pleasure. Gary, man, it was great to see you again. I'm glad you're doing well, and I appreciate you speaking with me again.
Okay. Take care.
Bye, Gary.
Do it again.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.